Listen, let's talk about Shemaya Kahuna. Shemaya Kahuna is a beautiful Gishmaka topic. And as I was indicating before, it's huge. There are several entire Sfarim that are written about this topic. And it's a concept that applies in many, many mitzvos. In Sfiras Omer, it has a particular relevance. We'll see if we get to that, and maybe we'll incorporate that part into a more Sfira-focused topic. But just to first talk about the general topic of Shemaya Kahuna, so we're not going to discuss how it comes up in every mitzvah, but we'll try to at least get the yesodos down. And it's really a beautiful sugya, and we'll get a little bit of a perspective, like so many of these major Shas sugyas. So its makor is really in Masechet Sukkah. Masechet Sukkah is really where it's addressed head-on in the clearest way. So if you had to pick one Masechta to be the home of Shemaya Kahuna, Sukkah would be it. We discussed on Sunday they were going a little bit out of order now, just for reasons of efficiency. So while this is justified as a Sukkah Sugya, it's not exactly what we're up to. We plan on coming back to Baal Tosef, which is really starting earlier, but we're mochel on the order. So we can learn Sugya is the Mafrei, it's not Ma'akev, apparently. That's the conclusion on that point. So to talk about Shemaya Kahuna, so you've got a chance to see that the Gemara and Mamuches and Masechet Sukkah tells us that there is such a concept and that it's derived from a pasuk. So to start off with, I want to ask you the following question. I want you to translate the phrase for me. And for now, let's set aside the question of the somewhat surprising usage of the word onet in the place of the speech. You probably would have chosen, if I were to ask you to translate into Hebrew a concept of speech, you probably would have picked a number of other words. There are a lot of choices in Hebrew. Onet may not be the first one that came to mind. Onet has this connotation of answering, of a responsive type of speech. Let's set aside that question for a second. Let's assume for our purposes that Onet and, say, Omer, where Omer and Aleph are synonymous for our purposes now. So not focusing on the choice of Onet as opposed to Omer, how could you translate the phrase Shemaya Kahuna? I think there are at least two ways to translate it, and it makes a difference. Go on.
I think the difference would be, compared to whether he actually is the one saying it, or it's like he's not saying it, but he's kind of fulfilling what's being said.
Okay, you're doing very well, but you're a little bit ahead of us. Okay, I think you're asking an important question, but before we're trying to get to that question, so the question first could be prompted by simple translation. You're going right to the Lugdish translation, which is, we'll get there in a minute, hopefully. But just translate the phrase, Shemaya Kahuna. What does it mean in English? Jacob?
One who listens is like one who says.
Okay, that is one possible translation. Right? The one who listens is like the one who says. So if that's the translation, we're talking about comparing people. The one who listens is like the one who says. So essentially, the phrase really would be Hashemeya ke ha'oneh. That's essentially what we're understanding from that phrase. What's the other way to understand it? Yes, Daniel?
Listening is like saying.
Ah, so it could be we're comparing verbs, and that Shomeya ke'oneh translates into English as to listen is the same as to speak. So that, right off the bat, sets the stage for a major question of trying to understand what this concept is about. Although we'll see ultimately, probably by tomorrow, we won't get to it all today, that I think this is only the first step in the discussion. But it's an important first step. What exactly is the translation of the phrase? Does Shomeya Kahuna mean we are comparing people? Hashemeya ke ha'ona, like Jacob said. Or does that translate to comparing actions, like Daniel's saying, really, to be Shomeya is as if one is being Onan, Now, essentially, from a Lavdisha perspective, that seems to play out the way that Gilad suggested. Right? That do we say that Shmiya is Ka'aniya, that the act of listening counts as the act of speaking? Or should we say that no, it's not really that speaking and listening are somehow equated, but it's that the individual who does the listening somehow is credited with the mitzvah to the same degree as the one who's actually doing the speaking? Gilad, is that a fair read of what you said?
Fair enough.
Okay, so we see that before you get to that, how it really could just go to a simple translation. What do the words mean? What does it mean to say Shomea Kaona? Ha Shomea Ki Haona? Or Shmiya Ki Ania? Now, it would seem like this is a debate that underlies a lot of issues that have been dealt with throughout the generations. And we'll go in reverse order historically to address this. So we'll start from some of the Achronim and then work backwards towards the Rishonim, where you see that this issue seems to be playing out. And again, if we had the time or we had the ability to focus specifically on this topic, we could probably come up with dozens of places where you find this issue playing out. I don't think we'll do that many, but just to highlight some of the key discussions will give us a little bit of a perspective, and then ultimately we'll see that I think this is actually not the last word, but this is the first step towards a more fundamental understanding of what's going on. So to work again backwards in history, there was a controversial statement of the Beis Halevi. Beis Halevi, the original of Yeshua Ber Soloveitchik, has a comment in his Sefer. Which Sefer? Well, Hilchos Chanukah, obviously. Because where else would it be? And of course, where do you find Hilchos Chanukah? In the Sefer Al Torah, obviously, because where else would that be? Where the Torah? So after beginning of Shmos, obviously, because where else would it be? So that actually is kind of nice, because the Beis Halevi Al Torah actually stops in the middle of Shmos. We don't have the rest of it. So at the end of the Sefer, there's a few points about Chanukah, and he also has this point, which is not really in the context of Chanukah. But it has to do with his disagreement with another great Gadol, who he does not name, but because you're lucky, I will let you in on who it was. So the Beis Halevi quotes a Chacham Achash, who he disagrees with. And it has to do with the interpretation of the Mishnah, which I put on today's list. So the Mishnah Masachas Megillah. The Mishnah Megillah talks about somebody who gets the Haftorah. Nowadays, it's considered to be a big covenant to get the Haftorah. But halachically or historically, it actually is not considered to be the greatest covenant. Don't tell the people who are actually getting it. Because it's not one of the Zion Kruim. So the person who got the Haftorah would usually get consolation prizes with other kibbutim, which also happens today very often. The person who's mafter often davens Musa, things like that. So in that context, the Mishnah says among the things that he does is who knows as kapla, right? He davens. So the question presents itself right away. What are you talking about, hiduchins? Hiduchining is not a kavod that you can give out to people. Mimonashah. If the guy we're talking about is a Kohen, so then all the Kohanim are duchening. And if he's not a Kohen, then he can't duchen anyway. So what does it mean to single out this one person as being given the honor of Nesias Kapayim? So this is a question, and one answer that was suggested by this anonymous chacham, who will only be anonymous for another few minutes, a few seconds, this anonymous chacham said that what was going on in that context is that Birchas Kohanim was done differently than it's done nowadays in our shuls, and we didn't have every Kohen going up for Birchas Kohanim. But instead, one Kohen would get up, and through Shamei Kaona, he'd be motzi the other Kohen. So we would have only one, and we'd invoke Shamei Kaona to fulfill the obligation of all the other Kohen. So who was this anonymous Chacham? So the anonymous Chacham was Shlomo Bidoma, who is the author of the Sefer Binyan Shlomo, and he was either a genius or a super genius. I forget which one, because Rashachti often says there were two brothers, Rishon Mivilna and Bitzal Mivilna. One was a genius and one was a super genius. So I don't know which one he was, but he was clearly up there. And he recorded that when he visited the city of Trieste, that's what he saw, that there was Shemei Kaona used for Berchas Kohanim, and that's Pshat in the Mishnah. So the Beis Halevi disagreed. The Beis Halevi said, no, it's not true. Can't be pshat, because Shemei Kaona cannot work for Berchas Kohanim. Berchas Kohanim cannot be done through Shemei Kaona. Now the question is why? So here's where things get a little complicated, so you have to say it carefully. First of all, I should mention parenthetically that the Beis Halevi and the Netziv, point of history, were both Rashi Yeshiva and Galajim together, and there was some tension at some points, but happens to be they agree on this issue. Both the Beis Halevi and the Netziv maintain that Shemei Kaona is not effective for Berchas Kohanim. The Netziv has a tshuva where he says that, and he has a whole different explanation, so we're not going to focus on his presentation at this point. But just for the record, the other Rashi of Galajim, the Netziv, also concluded the same point for different reasons. But the Beis Halevi's explanation is what we're trying to figure out here. The Beis Halevi explains in a way that's a matter of dispute. So I'm first going to mention the alleged explanation of the Beis Halevi. And we'll soon see that not everyone agrees that that's what he meant. So it's a little awkward, but that'll be the way we refer to it. The alleged explanation of the Beis Halevi is as follows. Why is Shemei Kaona not effective for Berchas Kohanim? Because what does Shemei Kaona mean? What does Shemei Kaona accomplish? He works off the assumption that Shemei Kaona is a comparison of verbs. Shmia is like ania. To listen is as if you are speaking. Halachically, for whatever reason, we consider listening to be as if you're speaking. So that's all very well and good. If all the mitzvah requires is that you speak, if that's all you have to do, it's okay. So Shemei Kaona can theoretically be a great tool. But if the mitzvah requires something more than speech, then you're in trouble. Because what good is listening going to do? It's not going to accomplish those other areas. So what does he mean when he refers to Berchas Kohanim as needing something more than speech? So I would have guessed like that. So I would have thought that that's what he means. That especially since we call it Nesias Kapayim, right? It literally means to lift up one's hand. So I would have thought that that's what he was coming from. That since it also requires speech given in that position with the hands outstretched, so that's going to be lacking. What good is it to listen to somebody else if you don't have that component? Now, theoretically, maybe it was possible to do it that way. Maybe they all stood up there and stretched out their hands, and one Kohen did the talking. That's not impossible. So maybe that's why it's not the focus here. But it's actually not where he's coming from. The issue is, and this might relate to the whole debate over what he's really getting at, because that's going to be a key component, that has to do with the nature of the speech. That it's not just any speech that qualifies for Berchas Kohanim, but as we Baruch Hashem here in Yeshiva, we have the privilege, I don't know how many of you have been here for Yontif, but we have the privilege of having Rabbi Yitzchak Cohen Shlita as one of the representational Kohanim, so he is the best Kiyum on many levels of this idea, that it has to be the Kol Rom, it has to be loud. So, allegedly, says the Beis Halevi, Let's say you're going to listen and you're going to be using Shemaya Kaona. All right, Shemaya is like speech. That's great. Listening is like talking. But is it like talking loud? What if you would get up there and whisper? And whispering would also be speech, for sure. As we know from the practice of talking in shul. Right, so whispering would also is also speech. Happens to be there's what to argue about that, but don't tell people talking in shul. But whispering is also speech, but it wouldn't be a fulfillment of the requirements of Brachas Kohanim because it's not loud. So you'll say, all right, Shemei is Kohanim, that's great, but it doesn't satisfy Brachas Kohanim because the speech has to be a certain way, and it's not that way. Daniel?
What if the person who is appointed by the Zimor to be Mr. Kapayan, but if he is loud, is that not?
Okay, so think about that. So why should that help? If the other Kohanim are fulfilling their obligations through listening, so how does his loud voice help?
It's as if he is being kind of mitzvah by being loud, then they're listening to him being kind of mitzvah.
Okay, so many will agree with you. But by agreeing with you, and by saying it the way you're saying it, you're moving into a different understanding, it seems. Because essentially, the Beis Halevi's point is that, okay, your listening is called speech, and only speech, not anything else. So therefore, it doesn't address volume or any other issue. What you want to say is that, no, let's not just call it speech. Let's consider it a connection to the one who is actively doing the mitzvah. And therefore, whatever conditions are in play, when that lead participant does the mitzvah, that should be credited to the listener also. So that, you're right, would explain how it could work, that if he's speaking loudly, they're all speaking loudly. But that brings you into a different understanding. Right? That shifts from shmiya ka'aniya to hashomeya ke'ha'oneh. That the one doing the listening is connected to the one speaking, and therefore whatever he's doing transfers over with all of its details. Daniel?
So according to Basil, when you get the Kimosh Megona, it's only as if you spoke in a normal tone?
It doesn't have any extra conditions. There's no extra modifying definition.
So what's the base? Doesn't it?
So presumably the base is a stam speech, and if it requires unusual speech, requires speech with some kind of modification, then that's not going to count. And again, we'll come back to it in a minute, the fact that not everyone agrees that that's what he means. So this was a disputed point. Among the great Bar Pluktas on this point is the Chazon Ish. Chazon Ish writing much later, Chazon Ish writing in the 1900s, expressed a different view of what Shemaya Kaona means. And you have to address otherwise various problems that come up. Because what are the most common mitzvos nowadays that we use Shemaya Kaona for? Kiddush is one, right? What else?
Megillah.
Okay, those are the two I was looking for. So very good. So Kiddush and Megillah. So those two mitzvos are very commonly performed through Shemaya Kaona. However, both of them, if the Beis Halevi's alleged theory is correct, we're going to have big problems. Right? Because Kiddush, for example, has to be recited al hakos. When we have large gatherings, whether they're one family or many families together, and there's one Kiddush being recited, we don't insist that every person who's listening have a full kos. Maybe they'll have a little bit, they'll have a taste, maybe they will, maybe they won't, but we certainly don't require a full kos being held by everybody listening. So according to the ABH, the alleged Beis Halevi, so how does that work? Or what about Megillah? It's perhaps a bigger problem. And when it comes to Megillah, want to answer that?
No, that's a question on Kiddush. Would it make a difference on how you understand the curse for Kiddush?
It might. You could get to the Lumbish Roll. That would bring some interesting discussions into play. And we alluded to that a little bit last week in our discussion by Rav Kook's Tshuva about the wine that was non-kosher. But for now, it's a major tangent, which we'll slide for a second. But Megillah would seem to be a bigger problem, right? So let's say you sit in shul on Purim and you listen to the whole Megillah. So it's as if you read the whole Megillah. It's as if you said all the words in Megillah, rather. So, great. So you said all the words in Megillah. But you have a kosher Megillah in front of you? Most people do not. Maybe some do, but most people don't. So according to this understanding, shouldn't we require that everybody have a kosher Megillah in front of them in order to be Yotzeh? So these are two pretty glaring questions. In fact, just parenthetically on that point about the Megillah, so we know that we have a practice that when the Baal Kori gets up to the Aseres Bnei Haman, so the people in the crowd read those words themselves. And there are different explanations as to why that is. The explanation that's associated with the Ragachaga, the Sophis Panea, is that it's like the Beis Halevi, that if we have to read those names to the Shema Acha, it's supposed to be in one breath, so therefore we can't fulfill that through Shema Ka'ona, and we have to do that on our own. So the big problem is, if you say that, then why is it okay to do that without a kosher Megillah in front of you? If the other conditions don't come along with Shema Ka'ona, so how does it work that you can fulfill the Megillah without having a kosher Megillah? So it's a little bit of a challenging interpretation. It could be that the practice is really, since the Baal Kori is reading it all in the Shema Acha, there's a greater chance that you'll miss a word. So better for you to read those words yourself, because you can do up to 49% of the Megillah from a non-kosher Megillah. So better you read those words on your own from your printed Megillah rather than rely on hearing it from the Baal Kori who's doing it in the Shema Acha, perhaps. But in any event, so it would seem like Megillah and Kiddush, these major mitzvos, are very, very challenging if we're going to follow the alleged Beis Halevi position. So therefore, could be that we should take a different understanding, like Daniel was saying, and like the Chazon Ish understood, that it's not that we are comparing verbs. We're not saying that Shmia is like Aniya. Rather, we are comparing people. The mechanism of Shemei Ka'ona means that the person doing the listening is linked to the person doing the talking, and whatever conditions are applied to the talker are transferred over to the listener. So if the talker is doing his mitzvah with a kosher Megillah, or with a cup of wine, or with a loud voice, all of those conditions are given over to the listener, and he is credited with the full mitzvah performance. Is that good for us?
Does that mean that the one listening, right, does that mean he's on a lower level of fulfilling the mitzvah that just happened?
Well, what indicates that way so far?
I mean, because we just said that the one saying it is linked to the one listening to it.
Right.
So it's not the other way around. So well, obviously, when saying it is on a higher level, the one's listening.
Not so obvious. I mean, we need somebody doing it actively or else we don't have that. So we have a home base here, clearly. Somebody's got to be the home base.
Correct, but then we said that one's linked to that one because there's no shmia without anyone.
Right, so that's the only direction we can really go in. I don't know if it necessarily means the listener is worse. That's something we'll try to address a little bit in a different context in a few minutes. But you kind of have to at least go in that direction because you need somebody actively doing it to generate the listening. So that doesn't necessarily show us anything. We'll see more if we have an indication one way or another.
How do you have to take these positions when clearly a brash and close was not
a good size? Okay, so as we'll see, when we're going back in history, we'll see that these issues seem to be present in earlier discussions as well, and we'll try to see what we can do with that. So now, as far as the Beis Halevi, who ends up really being on the defensive here because of these other questions, so it's only fair to point out that, like we've been using the word alleged, there is some argument, many later Acharonim feel, that the Beis Halevi did not mean this. It did not mean to take a position that would have caused problems for Kiddush and Megillah. And rather, he was making a different point. What he was really saying is not that the sound has to be loud, the speaking has to be loud, and therefore that's a problem because other conditions don't carry through with Shema Ka'ona. No, what he means to say is that the nature of the mitzvah of Brachas Kohanim is that there has to be a process that connects the Kohen and the congregation. The congregation has to actually hear the Kohanim. So it's not about there being some external condition. It's that that's what the mitzvah is. The mitzvah requires a communication. That's why it has to be loud. So if the people can't hear the Kohanim, so then the mitzvah is not happening. So that's the whole nature of the mitzvah. It's not like other mitzvahs of Kiddush or Megillah where you have to say something. And there are also other conditions that go along with the speech. The whole speaking is of a certain type. The whole speaking is that it has to involve communication between the Kohanim and the congregation. And that's lacking here. So this doesn't say anything about how Kiddush should be made. Doesn't say anything about Megillah. It's specifically an issue for Brachas Kohanim and should not be taken in this understanding to apply to anything else. Now, to give also fair due to this explanation, the Achronim who say this are generally those who are within the circles of the Beis Halevi, from the Soloveitchik family, or the students of the members of the Soloveitchik family. So there's a little bit of extra credibility, I believe, of Soloveitchik. Heard about this morning, the namesake of the Beis Halevi also understood his great-grandfather that way. I think that those who specifically have the greatest connection to the Beis Halevi's tradition understood him this way, but that's what he meant, and this should not be taken as a part of the general verb person question, Shamea Ke'one, HaShamea Ke'one, or Shamea Ke'aniya, but it's a detail that is specific to Berachas Kohanim. But in any event, whether he meant it or not, the Beis Halevi has been drafted into this fight, and it's understood by many that that's what's going on. The Beis Halevi and the Chazon Ish, Beis Halevi says, Shmiya is Ka'aniya, and the Chazon Ish says, HaShemeya is Ke Ha'Onen. So far, so good? Make sense? Hey, Daniel?
So, according to the second theory, like, if everybody in the congregation covers their ears, then the Kohanim don't get a kiyum because they...
I don't know if that's the way it works. If it's the, you know, the, if they're going to get in the way, then presumably that's their problem. But they have to do it in such a way that it's communication to the people. Presumably that's what it would mean, I would say. Hi.
Well, can you explain the finish of that? That you obviously, if they can hear it, then they're not, it's not going to be good. Why is that?
Well, as far as Shemaya Kohen is concerned, not necessarily, because no one is saying that the Israelim are using Shemaya Kohen. The question is, are the other Kohanim using Shemaya Kohen? That is the understanding of that mission in Megillah, that only one Kohen is speaking, and the other Kohanim are fulfilling their obligation through listening to him. But what Daniel is saying now is that because we understood the Beis Halevi as saying, or these Soloveitchik, Brisker, Circle people are understanding the Beis Halevi to be saying that it's all about communicating with the people. That's why it has to be the Kol Rav, and it's not reflective of an issue that applies to all other conditions. Okay. So one could, if one wanted to follow the tangents and the Brachas Kohanim, one could get into the whole question of whether the mitzvah is only on the Kohanim or also on the Israelim. It's a fascinating discussion. It's going to take us far afield. Okay, so this is stage one in our historical tour. The Beis Halevi and the Chazon Ish weren't exactly in the same generation, in the same century, but they're the later ones that we're starting off with, working backwards. Let's go back a little bit as far as the Beis Halevi is concerned, and let's go to Rabbi Yaakov Emden. Rabbi Yaakov Emden died in 1776, that's how you can remember when the revolution was. So Rabbi Yaakov Emden has a tshuva where he argues on the Taz. Because the question came up, it's a very important halacha l'maaseh question, comes up all the time. Also, to discuss it in full details outside our scope, but just to seize on this one debate about it, is it possible to give an aliyah to the Torah to somebody who is blind? Can you give an aliyah to somebody who can't see? So, on the surface, one might say, no. How could you do that? Because historically, the way aliyahs were given is different than what we have nowadays. Right? What does it really mean to get an aliyah? It means that the person is supposed to get up and lame. That's what an aliyah historically meant. nowadays we're not confident that every single person is able to get off the lane just the moment they are called. I mean, you guys all can, but you know, we're not confident that everybody, the moment they're called without any warning, they're able to lay. So we have a practice that we have a professional Baal Koreh, and he lanes, and it's the job of the Oleh to go up there and make the brachos, and he reads along together with the Baal Koreh, he reads quietly. So that's how we do it nowadays. But if we assume that it's about the person laning, so how does the discussion get off the ground? So the Taz took the position, and the Taz said, and I think this is the way most assume, and commonly is the case, that blind people are given aliyahs today, that the Taz says, well, we're lucky that we don't do it the same way anymore. That since nowadays the person getting the aliyah does not actually have the job of reading from the Torah, there is a professional who reads from the Torah, so therefore the Ola is able to use Shomea Ka'ona. So because of Shomea Ka'ona and the fact that we don't actually expect him to be the primary reader, so we're able to give aliyahs to blind people. Now you may ask, parenthetically, it's a good question, that if we're using Shomea Ka'ona, so also by sighted people, why don't we say that anytime you get an aliyah, you don't have to read along with the Baal Koreh, just listen, like you do with Kiddush or Miguel or anything else. Why do we require that he actually read along? That's a fair question, and also a point we won't necessarily explore fully right now. But our major focus now is that the Taz says that it can work, and it does work because of Shomei Ka'on. So if Yaakov Edmund in the Tshuva, which if I remember correctly, I think the Tshuva was written poetically, all from the rhymes, so Yaakov Edmund writes that he doesn't think this could be. It's because what will be accomplished by using Shomei Ka'ona for Kriya Satara? Yes, it will be as if the Ola is saying all the words of the Aliyah, but it'll be as if he's saying them Baal Peh. They won't be read from the Torah. And we know that a common issue for Bar Mitzvah boys, right, that if the Baal Koreh is actually laning by heart rather than actually looking inside, so then that's a problem. It's a big problem. He has to read the Torah and not say the words by heart. So why is this Ola, who can't see the Torah, any better than somebody who happens to know the Aliyah by heart? So here it seems like you have the same debate. That essentially, according to the Taz, how are we translating Shomei Ka'ona? Or if it's easier to start from the other way, how is Rebbe Yaakov Emden translating Shomei Ka'ona? Which one do you want to work for? Exactly. I believe that's the case. That Rebbe Yaakov Emden lines up with the base of the alleged base of Levi here. That means that, how do you translate it? That
listening is like speaking.
Right, verbs. Listening is like speaking. So it's very good to credit you with saying the words. But that's not enough, because that's just like saying it by heart. While the Taz, how does the Taz translate it? How does the Taz translate Shomei Ka'ona? Yeah? HaShomei Ka'ona, like the Chazon Ish. So therefore, it doesn't matter that he himself is not reading from a Sefer Torah, since the primary speaker is reading from a Sefer Torah, so that is credited to the listener, and he gets all the details. Okay, who's up first? Zach?
So for that one, we definitely use that one for Miguel Sester, right?
Sorry?
We definitely use Hashomer Ka'ona for Miguel.
Well, that's where we mentioned before that the Beis HaLevi was a problem for that, because we'd have to understand how it works.
Right.
And if you really say that it's only about comparing verbs, it's a glaring question. How does Miguel Sester work? Unless one wants to be Machmir, and perhaps there are those who are so Machmir,
so you could
that
say
everyone goes to shul with a kosher Megillah, which they'll still be saving a lot. They won't have to learn the Megillah. They can sit and listen to somebody else. But maybe there were those who had such a chumrah that said that you have to own a Megillah that's kosher, and maybe do shul on Purim. And you don't have to learn how to read it because you can listen to somebody else. But maybe that's indeed the nature of the obligation. Okay, so we've seen now two steps in history, the Beis HaLevi Chazon Ish. seemingly arguing on the translation of Shemaya Kona. And to go back a little bit, in terms of basically being their background, they're not so far apart, but in terms of the Taz and the Chazanot, it's a little farther apart. To go back a little bit, you get to the Taz and Rebekah Vendon apparently arguing on the same points. What does Shemaya Kona mean? Is it a comparison of actions, or is it a comparison of people? So now, let's go back to Rishonim, and let's at least try to get this out for today, and then tomorrow we can look at phase two of this discussion. So this issue, as Avi pointed out before, seems to already be well established in the Rishonim, because this is a question that seems to be behind a major machlokas between Rashi and Tosfos. Rashi over here in Sukkah, and Tosfos in Masechtas Brachos. And if the question comes up, what would happen if normally you are supposed to respond when you're in shul and they're saying Kiddusha, so you're supposed to involve yourself and respond. But what would happen if, presumably you didn't come late to shul, because that never happens in the real world, but you say, longer Shemon Esrei, so you're still involved in Shemon Esrei when the Shliach Tzibur is saying Kiddusha. So what should you do? You're in the middle of Shemon Esrei and Kiddusha is happening. So it says Rashi, what's Rashi's opinion?
Rashi says you should pause, right?
Right.
You listen to us, so you should continue, because if you listen, then you'll be at the big break. You have to continue Shemon Esrei.
Okay, exactly, right? So Rashi say that, well, slowly, that according to Rashi here in Sukkah, what you do is you listen to the Shemona Esrei, and you stop and you pause, and therefore, here it's the bottom of Lamech Chesem Beis, you might as well look inside, since it's in our Lamech Sefta here. V'chein v'spalim b'tzibur, somebody's dabbling b'tzibur, v'shech tzibur omar kaddish, or yehesh merabba, yishtaku b'tfilasa, and they should just be silent, v'yishmu b'kavana, and they will listen with intent. The harei hein keonim. So then they are as if they're answering. Upshigmar kedusha actual tefillah. And then when kedusha finishes, they'll continue with Shemona Esrei. And he quotes the Bahag as taking this view. So Tosfos says that's a disastrous idea. Because if you're going to do that, so then that's going to be worse. Because if Shemaya is really keonim, so that's exactly what you didn't want to do, right? The whole problem was that you can't speak in the middle of Shemona Esrei. It would be a hefsek. So how are you helping things by doing Shomeya Keone? That's exactly the problem. That's exactly what you want to avoid. Because now it's as if you are speaking. So Tosfos says better to skip this whole plan. Yes, Jed.
Doesn't he say that we saw the minhag to staff?
Yeah, the practicalities are, I mean, that is our practice nowadays. But this is Tosfos's issue that you should say that it's not going to be a good idea, because you're going to get yourself in the same problem that you are trying to avoid. So, yes, sir.
But isn't the minhag? Shouldn't the minhag of his time be indicative of the fact that Shemaya Kona was interpreted by Rashi?
Okay, you're asking a fair question. It's hard to know how to address that, but this is essentially Tosfos' problem, that it seems like you're undermining yourself, that this is exactly what you were trying to not do in the first place. So how do we explain these views? So we'll mention probably tomorrow there are a few other more creative explanations, but it seems like on the surface that this is an argument along the lines of what we've been discussing. That according to Tosfos, how do you translate Shemaya Kona? That what? Which one?
Shemaya Kona. Listening is like
speaking. That's right, you have to do a little more. Right, listen, the listening is like speaking. Right, we're comparing verbs, essentially in line with, just to keep track, right? The base Alevi and the back of ending. Right, so is actually considered as if you're speaking. Now it's important to see here, because this also goes to Adam's question, that while this does line up, this is a very different application of this idea. That until now, it was a deficiency. It's part of why we're looking at this way backwards in history. that until now, the way the Rabbi Yaakov Emden understood it, and the Beis Halevi understood it, this represented a missing factor, that Shemeya Ka'ona is limited in that it's only speech and not other elements. While here, this is a different point of emphasis in the same position. That because we're comparing words, we're comparing speech to speaking, we're listening to speaking, so therefore it's too much. Not that it's too little, it's too much. That we're trying to avoid actual speech. And Rashi says, well, do this instead of speaking. So Tosfos says, no good. That's like actually speaking. And actually speaking is a hafsik. It's not going to help us. So what is the position of Rashi then, by contrast? Rashi's position is like what? Where does it fit with? Taz and Ish, and the Taz, and the translation is what? Hashomeya Kehaonin. But now this is a different angle on what it means. Until now we've been saying that the thrust of Hashomeya Kehaonin is that whatever conditions are present for the speaker are transferred over to the listener. Here, the emphasis is very different. It's the same idea playing out in a whole different way. That it's not about you speaking. When you listen, the way you fulfill the mitzvah, according to Rashi, seems to be that it's not that you are considered to be speaking. It's that you fulfill your mitzvah through a connection to the speaker. So the speaker is the one doing the talking, and somehow your listening connects you to him. So that seems to be where Rashi is coming from. Rashi understood that, oh, if you're trying to avoid speaking, what good is something that's like speaking? So his answer is, because it's not like speaking. What it means is that there's another route to performing the mitzvah that does not require you speaking. It requires you listening. And listening maybe shouldn't be considered a hafsik, and therefore that's going to solve your problem. So the same positions that we've seen till now seem to be represented in Rashi and Tosfos, but the emphasis is very different. It's the same idea, but it's the other half of what that implies, and it plays out in a significantly different way. Yes, sir?
Isn't it hard to understand that listening is not a message at all?
So then you could also bring up another concern. Right? You could say, all right, fine, it's not like speaking, but can I turn on the radio in the middle of Shemoneh Esrei? Yeah. Can I answer
something? You're stopping the Shemoneh Esrei in the middle. Like,
right, so that's a fair point, and it's something that requires a little bit more of a detailed understanding of what exactly is hafsik. So that's also a little bit outside of our scope. But your point is well taken. Okay, just because you're not speaking, but if somebody wants to come tell you the sports scores and you'll just pause without saying anything, would anyone think that's appropriate in the middle of Shemoneh Esrei? Presumably not. So what's the difference? A fair question, but for now we'll assume that a hefsik is defined as actually talking, and Rashi says, okay, here's another route which doesn't involve talking, and that's going to be better. So that's Daniel.
Those sports like Salah and Mesa are pretty consistent. Because mm-hmm. I always thought we'd post in like Rashi that you're supposed to stop Kedusha.
We do.
But then for Kiddush and Gila, we also want to hear Kayim even though you're not holding the cup world.
Yeah, which actually lines up. We're associating Rashi with that view. We're associating Rashi with Chazanish and with the Taz. So it happens to be that in all three cases, it seems like we land on the same side.
Wait, how? So I didn't get how Rashi is like the Chazanish.
Because Rashi basically understands that we're not saying listening is like talking. We're saying the listener is like the speaker. So he gets credited with whatever the speaker is doing. So he doesn't need his own coast, because the speaker has his own coast. And also, a very different implication in the same position, he's not being mastered because he's not talking. It's not even like he's talking. He is like the talker. The talker is fulfilling a mitzvah. He fulfills the mitzvah through association with him. But he's not actually doing the speaking. So it seems in all three cases, we land most commonly, even though there's room to argue in all the situations, but it seems that the most prevalent practice is in line with all of those consistently. That we don't assume everyone needs to have their own Kiddush Kapper Kosher Megillah like the Chazon Ish. We allow blind people to have Aliyahs like the Taz. And we tell you to pause in the middle of Shemoneh Esrei like Rashi. Those all line up in the same view. So had they contradicted, there could be what to discuss about what's different in each situation. But it happens to be that it seems, does seem to work in terms of what our current practices. So I just want to add one other major detail here, and then God willing tomorrow we'll start with phase two, because this is all preliminary, and we can now use that to move into a different, somewhat deeper discussion of what's going on. But just to add one detail to this Machlokas Rashi and Tosfos about Shimon Esrei, there is a third view, just for comprehensive sake, the Shiboli Haleket, who's one of the Rishonim. Shiboli Haleket argued on both Rashi and Tosfos, because Rashi says this is a good plan, and Tosfos says, no, don't do it because it'll cause other problems. So Shiboli Haleket disagrees with both of them, and he says, doesn't even work. Not even effective. The stopping in the middle and trying to use Shemek Ona to be Yotze answering conclusion. So Shibali, like it says, not even a plan. A good plan or a bad plan, it's not a plan at all. Why? Because there is a rule, I think we mentioned in other contexts here, there is a rule in general in Torah of Kalaroi Lubila. Right? We discussed that in the past. That kalaroi lubila, it's referring to one specific sugi, that's where the bila comes in. But the basic gist of the rule is that when you have a din that's a chatila, and you have a way of doing it b'di'evet, so it means, okay, b'di'evet, you don't have to have all the conditions. But the lachatila condition, even if you don't have to have that, it has to be possible. When the lachatila condition is not even possible, then it's no good. Right, we mentioned this principle in the past. So it says the Shiboli Haleket, Shemeya Ka'oneh can only work for someone who could speak. For someone who cannot speak, Shemeya Ka'oneh is not an option. Now the Shiboli Haleket is saying a couple of chidushim. One chiddush is that he applies kalaroi levila to shemeya ka'ona, and we'll mention in a second why that's debatable. I want to address that, so we'll come back in a second. Sorry?
Just a question in terms of its application. Is there anywhere that we see where kalaroi levila can and cannot apply?
Not exactly. There are a couple of sugyas which mention it. The parameters are not spelled out in terms of what's going to exclude. But first, his Shiboli Haleket's assumption is that it applies to Shemeya Ka'ona, which we'll see in a second why that's debatable. And the second issue is that he's assuming that it applies also to a halachic impossibility. That because you are quite capable of speaking physically, but nonetheless you're halachically not allowed to, that's called in a royal reveal in his understanding. So the fact that you are halachically prevented, that's what gets in your way. So that's a double chiddush. And the first chiddush already was objected to by the Shagas Aryeh. Shagas Aryeh lived later, but Shagas Aryeh never hesitated to argue on Rishonim, especially here we have other Rishonim who were clearly working off a different understanding. And the Shagas Aryeh in Siman Vav says he doesn't think that this is a correct application. Because he was talking there, his issue was, what if somebody is mute? He's not able to talk. And wants to fulfill Kriya Shema. Can he listen to somebody else's Kriya Shema and use Shomei Ka'ona? So here, it's not a halachic issue, it's a physical issue. So this is a more clear-cut arena for Kalaroi Lubila to be applicable. But, says the Shagas Aryeh, this is going to be a crucial point for us, the whole concept doesn't come into play. Because when does Kalaroi Lubila apply? So the way we explained it a minute or two ago, we said it applies when you have a lechatchila and a bidyeva, when there is an ideal way to do the mitzvah, and then there's an acceptable way that doesn't have all those conditions. So when that's there, it's okay, you can talk about kalaroi levila. But says the Shagas Aryeh, the implication is that shomei ka'ona, and this goes back to Zach's question from the beginning of today, The implication is that Shemei Kaona is b'di'evit. L'chanchila, you'll always be the one doing the talking. But b'di'evit, if you just hear, it's also okay. And says the Shagas Aryeh, that's not true l'halacha. Do we assume that, right? Do we assume that everybody who goes to shul and listens to someone else read the Megillah, or everyone who listens to someone else make Kiddush at home or in a larger group, all those people are only Yotzei b'di'evit? We don't say like that. We assume that this is an alternate route that is equally valid. That one can fulfill Kiddush either through being the one speaking or by being the one listening. So therefore, the whole concept of Kol Ruach Lebila doesn't come in and it shouldn't interfere with this Kriya Shema plan. Now, it happens to be that, here's another tangent, that there were Achronim such as the Vilna Gaon. Vilna Gaon was the next generation. Vilna Gaon met the Shagas Aryeh when he was a young man. When Shagas Aryeh was old and Vilna Gaon was young, he met the Shagas Aryeh. So the Vilna Gaon was of the opinion that for other reasons, Kriya Shema does not work through Shemei Kaona. And we could try maybe tomorrow to talk about why that might be. But that's clearly a point of Machlokis. And in fact, if you want to know the cute word, sort of, so the Vilna Gaon writes, where does he express this? This is in his commentary to the Mishnayos, called the Shnos Eliyahu, to the first Mishnah in Shas, first Mishnah in Brachos. So the first Mishnah, what's the first words of Shas? Me Masai Koren Es Shema. From when do we read the Shema? So what's the first word of Maseches Megillah? It says Megillah Nikres. Megillah is read, singular. So says the Vilna Gaon, why is it that Brachos starts off Kriya Shema plural? When do we read the Shema? And Megillah starts off singular. When is the Megillah read by a single individual? So he says, because when it comes to Megillah, it's done through Shemei Kaona. So one person is reading the Megillah, and everyone else is listening. But when it comes to Shema, you can't use Shemei Kaona, so everyone else has to be doing it on their own, so it's plural. The Ritva already said half of this. Look at the Ritva Megillah, he says that part, that it's reflecting a Shemei Kaona understanding. But this is the Vilna Gaon's Chiddush, that when it comes to Shema, you have to have everyone doing it on their own. So why that is, again, we could talk about that, but for now, these are the bare elements of the discussion. So just to recap, what have we seen so far? So we started off asking, how do we understand Shemei Kaona? Is it referring to comparing verbs, speaking is like, listening is like speaking, or is it comparing people, the one listening is like the one speaking? And that parallels the Lamdisha question. Is Shomei Kaona simply a way of listening instead of speaking, but listening therefore just fulfills the role of speaking, comparing verbs? Or is Shomei Kaona a whole different thing? It's that by listening, you somehow connect to the speaker and fulfill the mitzvah through him. And that's comparing people, HaShomei Kaona. And we saw, moving backwards in history, that this opinion of Shmiya Ka'aniyah was attributed to the Beis HaLevi, who was accused of saying that you can't be Yotzei Brechas Kohanim through Shemei Kaona because it needs more than just words. And the Chazon Ish disagreed and said, no, the whole condition comes with the one who listens, and therefore the same way we can listen to Kiddush and not have our own cup, or we could listen to Megillah and not have our own Kosher Megillah, so that's how Shemei Kaona works. We mentioned that not everyone assumes the Beis HaLevi really meant that, and many close to him understood his words differently. Then we walked back into history and we saw that the Taz and Rabbi Yaakov Emden seem to be fighting about the same thing. That Rabbi Yaakov Emden says a blind man cannot get an aliyah because his Shomei Kaona, which the Taz allows, says Rabbi Yaakov Emden, it's not going to work because it's like he's reading Baal Peh. So according to Rabbi Yaakov Emden, it's that it's as if you're saying the words. And according to the Taz, it seems to be, it's not as if you're saying the words, it's that you connect to the speaker and whatever he's doing is credited to you as well. And then we saw, going further back in history, we showed him that the same understanding has very different implications in a machlokus between Rashi and Tosus. That Rashi says, if you're in the middle of Shmona Esrei, you can fulfill answering Kedusha just by listening and activating Shemei Kaona. And Tosus says, no good, if that's going to happen, it's going to be the very hefsek you are seeking to avoid. So Tosus seems to see listening as actually equal to speaking. While Rashi understands that it's not actually like speaking, it's that you are fulfilling the mitzvah through the speaker, so maybe it is a good way of threading the needle of being yotzei the mitzvah, but also not actively speaking. We mentioned that there's a third opinion here, the Shibali Alekhet, who says the whole plan doesn't work because you can't fulfill it through Shemei Ka'ona because you're not allowed to talk, and it's a deficiency of Kalaroi Lebila Ein Bilasa Makeves, or Sheinaroi Lebila Bilasa Makeves. So says the Shibali Alekhet to two chidushim, one that Kalaroi Lebila applies here, and two that a halachic inability is the same as a physical inability for this purpose. And the Shakas Agi disagreed. The Shakas Agi was talking about a case of actual physical inability, whether a mute person can fulfill the obligation of Kriya Shema through Shemei Ka'ona. And he said, we don't apply Kalaroi Labila because this is not B'dievet. This is totally fine. It's an alternate route to do it. And we're insulting a lot of our practices if we call that B'dievet. And that there we don't have to come on to the question of physical versus halachic for that discussion. But we also noted that the whole premise that Shemei Ka'ona works at all by Kriya Shema is debatable. The Vilna Gaon felt differently, and that was his interpretation of the Mishnah in Brachos. So this, again, is phase one. So this is a little bit of a survey of some of the lumdus of how Shemei Ka'ona works. And again, we could have given 10 or 12 more examples, and there are many more than that. Maybe tomorrow we'll add in another two or three just to illustrate the point. But that's essentially the path that it takes. What we'd like to go to tomorrow is the next level. Okay, so maybe we've seen different possibilities of the lumdus of Shemei Ka'ona. Do those possibilities tie into a more fundamental understanding of what Shemei Ka'ona is and how it actually operates? That's what we'll have to look into tomorrow. Okay, who would like to be our active Medaber Ona for...